Side 7. Eon by Greg Baer. Continuing on page 257. The presiding minister had advised Olney to report to Sir Ollaghan Toller immediately upon his arrival. Toller, advocate for T. Sven Hemphuis, the president of the Hexamon Nexus, was a radical Geshel who had chosen to maintain a completely human appearance. That the appearance bore no relation to his natal design, it had been adapted for maximum leadership qualities, did not mitigate the unusual conservatism. Most radical Geshels, including the president, had chosen neomorph shapes, which bore little relation to natural human forms. What Olney had to say, the PM judged, would be of extreme interest to the president. The president himself was unavailable, involved in a long-term conference on the problem of the impending Jark offensive. Toller was a kind of unofficial replacement. This did not please the Naderites, or even the members of Van Hemphuis's immediate staff. Toller was not an easy man to deal with. Olney had met the advocate once before, and had not liked him at all, though he had gained a healthy respect for his abilities. Toller kept his office in the most desirable professional wedge of Central City, no more than a few minutes tracting and just a few seconds shaft ascent from the Nexus chambers in the precinct's core. Once Olney had made arrangements for Patricia's quarters, but before he had had a chance to confer with his own advocate, he went to Toller's office. Toller had decorated the small rectangular space in the most simple and adaptable Geshel style. Decoration was spare. The major texture theme was platinum and steel, and the overall effect was harsh and unyielding. The president's advocate was not pleased with the news Olney brought. "The PM had no suspicion of this when you alone were sent?" Toller picked it. The symbols that flashed between the two men came from pictor torques around their necks, devices which generated and projected the graphic speak that had developed over the centuries in the Thistledown and in the Axis City. His information was highly equivocated, Olney said. All he knew was that the Thistledown had been reoccupied. Toller pictured an unpleasant image of a roiling nest of snake-like creatures. "This is extraordinary news, Sir Olney. Coming from anyone else, I would find it difficult to believe. But then you've brought one of them back with you, haven't you?" "Her name is Patricia Luisa Vasquez." "A genuine ancestor?" Olney nodded. "Why did you bring her back? As evidence?" "I could not leave her. She was close to discovering how to modify sixth chamber machinery." Toller raised his eyebrows and picked four orange circles of surprise. "What is this woman?" "A young mathematician," Olney said, "highly regarded by her superiors." "And you did nothing else to correct the situation you found on the Thistledown?" "The situation is highly unstable there. They will not be able to organize for some time, and I thought it best to consult with the President and the Nexus." "I'll inform the President, but you're aware we have our own major difficulties now. This conference, it could determine the whole course of the Axis City. And there's been considerable unrest and speculation among the Naderites, especially the Kozhanovsky faction. If they learn of this..." The pictured nest of serpent-like creatures glowed a furious orange-red. "Seclude this woman and keep your information to your immediate superiors." "She is secluded, and of course I perform my duties as instructed," Olney said. "She will have to have an advocate assigned to her, however." "If we can avoid that, we should." Toller regarded him with obvious suspicion and unease. "It is law. All non-citizens in the city, without defined legal status, must be assigned an advocate immediately." "There's no need for you to quote city law to me," Toller said. "I'll find an advocate and assign..."
"I've already assigned one," Olney interrupted.
Toller's expression changed to deep distaste.
"Who?"
"Sir Suliram Kikura." "I'm not acquainted with her." By the time he had finished the statement, Toller had a complete file on Kikura on hand, ready to be picked and interpreted. He scanned the file rapidly, shifting to implant logic, and found nothing he could criticize. "She seems acceptable. She will be sworn to keep Hexamon secrets."
"She has that clearance already."
"We're sitting on political chaos as it is," Toller said. "What you've done is bring back a lit fuse for Axis City's bomb. All, of course, in the name of duty."
You will inform the president immediately, Olmi asked, picking a sidebar request for permission to return to his work. As soon as possible, Toller replied. You'll prepare a full report for us, of course.
It is prepared, Olmi said. I can transfer it now.
Toller nodded, and Olmi touched his torque. High-speed transfer of the report was accomplished in less than 3 seconds. Toller touched his own torque in acknowledgement of receipt. Suliran Kikura lived in the outer layers of Central City, in one of 3 million tightly packed units reserved for single young corporeals of middle social and job standing. Her rooms were smaller than they appeared. The reality of spaciousness was far less important to her than it seemed to be to Olmi, who kept more primitive and larger quarters in Axis Nader. But part of what attracted her to Olmi was his age and differing attitudes, and his habit of every now and then giving her something truly interesting to work on. This is the biggest challenge I've ever faced, Suliran Kikura picked it at Olmi. I couldn't think of anyone more capable, he replied. They floated facing each other in the subdued light of her quarter's central space, surrounded by picted spheres on which were projected various interesting and relaxing textures. They had just made love, as they almost always made love, without enhancement, and using nothing more complicated than the quarter's traction fields. Olmi gestured at the spheres and made a face.
Simplicity? Ram Kikura asked.
Simplicity, please, he affirmed. She dimmed the lights on everything but themselves and erased the spheres from the decor. They had first met when he had inquired into the licensing process for creating a child. He had been interested mostly in a personality meld between himself and someone unspecified. This had been 30 years ago, when Ram Kikura was just beginning her practice. She had advised him on the procedures. Permission was easy enough to obtain for a corporeal homorph of his standing, but he had not carried it to the point of making a formal request. She had gathered that Olmi was more interested in the theory than the practice. One thing had led to another. She had pursued him, with some elegance and no small persistence, and he had acquiesced, allowing himself to be seduced in a hidden corner of Central City's forested zero-G walled. Olmi's work often took him far afield for years at a time, and what they had together, to most observers, would have seemed transitory, an off-and-on thing. Indeed, she had had relationships since, none permanent, even though it was once again the fashion to have relationships for 10 years or longer. Whenever Olmi had returned, she had somehow managed to be free of commitments. They never pressured each other. What existed between them was a relaxed, but by no means trivial, sensation of comfort and a high level of mutual interest. Each genuinely enjoyed hearing about the other's work and wondering where future tasks would take them. They were, after all, corporeal and usefully employed. Theirs was a position of considerable privilege. Of the 90 million citizens in the Axis City, corporeal or in city memory, only 15 million had important work to do, and of those, only 3 million worked more than a tenth of their living hours.
You seem to enjoy the task already, Olmi said.
It's my perverse nature. This is by far the oddest thing I've found you associated with. It's positively momentous.
It could be of staggering importance, he said out loud, his tone mock sepulchral.
No more picting?
No, let's think and talk this through slowly.
Fine, she said. You wish me to be her advocate. How much of an advocate do you think she'll need?
You can imagine, Olmi said. She's a complete innocent. She'll need complete social and psychological adjusting. She'll need protection. When her status is revealed, which is inevitable, I think, whatever the president and presiding minister wish, there will be a sensation.
You are putting it mildly, she said.
She ordered wine brought to them, and 3 static-controlled liquid spheres drifted into their light. She handed Olmi a straw, and they sipped.
You've seen Earth yourself?
He nodded. I went down the borehole with the Frant on my 2nd day in the Thistledown. I didn't think remotes would convince me quite as much as seeing with my own eyes.
Old-fashioned Olmi, Ram Kikura said, smiling. I'm afraid I would have done the same thing. And did you see the death?
Yes, he said, staring up into the darkness. He rubbed 2 fingers along the black fuzz dividing his 3 bands of hair.
Only by remote at first. There was a battle in the borehole, and I couldn't possibly have gotten through. But after the fighting stopped, I took the ship out and saw. Ram Kikura touched his hand. How did you feel? Have you ever wanted to cry? She looked at him carefully, trying to gauge how serious he was. No, she said. Well, I wanted to. And I've wanted to many times since, thinking about it. I tried to purge the feeling with Talcid on the way back, quite a few sessions. But Talcid couldn't cure all of it. I could feel our beginnings, a smudged, dirty, dead and dying world. He told her about Patricia's grief. Ram Kikura turned away in distaste. We cannot release as she did, he said. It isn't in us anymore, and perhaps that's something else we've lost. Grief is not productive. It simply represents an inefficiency in accepting change of status. There are Orthodox Naderites who still have the capacity, he said. They find grief a noble sentiment. Sometimes I envy them. You were organically conceived and born. You had the capacity at one time. You knew what it was like. Why did you give it up? To fit in, Olmi said. You wished to conform? For higher motives, yes. Ram Kikura shuddered. Our visitor is going to think us all very strange, you know. It's her privilege, Olmi said. Chapter 35. The storm began as a series of accelerated risings and fallings of air, circular cells rubbing against each other and generating a thick, tortured layer of clouds throughout the first chamber. Western Bloc scientists in the middle of the chamber along the Zero Road made quick measurements before retreating to their trucks. Dust and sand were kicked up in immense, slender twisters, which in turn uncoiled and gave way to thick curtains of dust. The dust clouds billowed and spread, bouncing from cap to cap like waves in a channel. Cameras at the borehole recorded the phenomenon, but there was nothing that could be done to control it. Either the storm was a planned part of the chamber's weather system, or the chamber had no effective weather control. It had not, after all, been a steadily occupied part of the stone. Weather control might not have been thought necessary. In the years of the stone's reoccupation, nothing of this violence and strength had ever happened. The dust clouds covered the valley floor and slowly settled into a soupy, opaque layer a few kilometers thick. Above the dust, water clouds became darker and darker. By 1700 hours, 6 hours after the storm's first high winds, rain fell through the dust and landed as great drops of mud. In the first compounds, people huddled in the bungalows, both alarmed and thrilled by the sudden change. Hoffman watched from her mud-splattered window, chewing on a knuckle with eyebrows raised. The surcease from tube light was welcome. This was the closest to night that anyone had experienced on the stone, and it made her feel drowsy and content. Lightning crackled throughout the chamber, and engineers and marines braved the wind and rain to fasten conducting rods to the buildings. In the Russian command bungalow, at the middle of the second compound, the storm and darkness were ignored. The argument over the political and command structure ran late into the sleeping period, with Bilizersky and Yazykov, most vehement, and Vyogorsky staying in the background. Mirsky insisted on a military organization and refused to reduce his power in any way or to share it equally with, and he emphasized the point, junior officers. Bilizersky proposed a true Soviet structure with a central party committee led by a general secretary. Vyogorsky was suggested, and a president and premier acting through a supreme Soviet. Just the day before, Mirsky and Pogodin, the commanding officer in the first chamber, had supervised the beginning of construction on a Russian compound in the fourth chamber. Permission had been granted to harvest wood from the thick forests. Tools were at a premium. Everything was at a premium. Negotiations over the second chamber had grown heated when NATO archaeologists protested the potential desecration of what they regarded as their site. Mirsky had brusquely informed Hoffman that the potato was no longer a monument, it was a refuge. That had worn him down. His long sessions in the third chamber library, often instead of sleeping, had added to his fatigue. And now this. We must situate our people before we decide the final political structure, Mirsky said. All we have are makeshift tents and this compound and Hoffman.
That bitch, Bilozerski commented dryly. She's worse than the fool Lanier.
Vyagorsky touched Bilozerski's shoulder, and the martinet sat down obediently. Vyagorsky's ascendancy among the political officers did not surprise Mirsky. Neither did it please him. Mirsky was sure he could handle Bilozerski, but with Vyagorsky's cunning, reserve, and authoritative speaking voice, and Yazykov's razor-sharp legal mind, Mirsky felt a nasty challenge brewing. Was there some way he could turn Vyagorsky and Yazykov, put their talents to his own advantage? In his favor, he felt, was his continuing education, or perhaps more accurately phrased, his enlightenment. Never before had he been able to wander at will through such a huge and diverse source of information. Soviet libraries, military and otherwise, had always been severely restricted, with books available only to those with a demonstrable need to know. Simple curiosity was frowned upon. He had been unsure even about the geography of his own country. History had been a subject in which he had never felt much interest, other than the history of space travel. What he learned in the Third Chamber Library was turning him around completely. To his colleagues, he revealed none of this. He took pains to conceal the fact that he now spoke English, German, and French, and was working on Japanese and Chinese. On the contrary, Bilozerski said, glancing at Vyagorsky, political considerations must always be foremost. We must abandon neither the revolution nor its ideals. We are the last fortress of...
Yes, yes, Mirsky said impatiently. Now, we are all tired. Let us rest and start again tomorrow.
He glanced over his shoulder at Garabedian, Kletnyov, and Sergei Prityikin, senior engineer from the science team.
Comrade Major Garabedian, will you escort these gentlemen to their tents and make sure our perimeters are secure?
There is more to be discussed than we have time for, Vyagorsky said.
Mirsky fixed his gaze on him and smiled.
True, he said. But tired men become angry men, and frustrations make for bad thinking.
There are other things which lead to weakness and bad thinking, Vyagorsky said.
Indeed, Bilozerski concurred.
Tomorrow, comrades, Mirsky persisted, ignoring the barb. We need to be fresh when we face Hoffman and continue the negotiations.
They filed out and left Prityikin and Kletnyov with Mirsky. The senior engineer and former squadron commander sat down at the tank-baffled table and waited as Mirsky rubbed his eyes and squeezed the bridge of his nose.
You realize what happens if Vyagorsky and his puppets take control, Mirsky said.
They are not reasonable men, Prityikin said.
Yet I believe about a third of the troops supports them wholeheartedly, and another third supports nobody.
General malcontents, Mirsky said.
I am the commander, so the malcontents dislike me. If it was Bilozerski alone, I wouldn't worry. The malcontents hate political officers even more. But Vyagorsky has a velvet tongue. Bilozerski lashes with words. Vyagorsky strokes. He can control a dangerous majority.
What do we do then, Comrade General? Kletnyov asked.
I want 5 men to guard each of you, handpicked by Garabedian or me. And I want 4 squads with AKVs around this bungalow.
Prityikin, I want the science team confined to the 4th chamber by the day after tomorrow.
Vyagorsky will not trust intellectuals. He may not tolerate their existence if push comes to shove.
The 2 left, and Mirsky was alone. He sighed and wished for something to take his mind away for the rest of the evening. A bottle of vodka, a woman, or more uninterrupted hours in the library. Never in his life had he felt more aware and more hopeful than he did now, even though surrounded by ignorant vipers.
Chapter 36 The tube rider was on automatic pilot, and all 4 of them slept in the cabin. Heinemann had limited the tube rider's speed to 9 kilometers per second. Something in the tube rider's construction caused a violent shudder beyond that. Lanier lay awake, restless, strapped to his reclined seat and staring up at the softly glowing orange light overhead. Heinemann was breathing steadily across the aisle from him. The women slept behind a curtain Carlson had rigged across the middle of the cabin. Carlson snored faintly. From Farley, he heard nothing. Sexual passion had seldom dominated Lanier. His drives were normal enough, but he had always been able to ignore them or control them in inappropriate situations. His 2-year celibacy on the stone had been less a hardship for him than it might have been for others. Nevertheless, he had never been hornier in his life than he was at this peaceful moment. Despite the advantages, he had always felt faintly ashamed of his lack of masculine anguish, as if it made him some sort of cold fish. Now the passion was upon him with a vengeance. It was all he could do to keep from stealing back through the curtain and fondling Farley. The desire was both funny and agonizing. He felt like a pubescent teenager, sweaty with need and unsure what to do about it. The psychiatrists in his head worked overtime. Death, said the Freudian, only strengthens our desire to procreate. So he lay sleepless, erect, unable to think clearly, and refusing to masturbate. The very idea was ridiculous. He hadn't masturbated in well over a year, and never except in complete privacy. Did the others feel this way? Heinemann certainly never let on. Not once, in fact, had Lanier ever heard Heinemann make a sexual comment, except in the most isolated and theoretical sort of joking. Did Farley feel this way? Just as a test, one hand reached up to pull aside the thin thermal blanket covering him. He forced the hand to pull it back. Madness. Finally, after an eternity, he slept. At 100,000 kilometers, the V-Stoll's forward-looking radar reported a massive obstruction ahead in the corridor. Heinemann searched the corridor borehole science records for any echoes from such a distance and found none. Looks like the physics people just shot a radar beam along the singularity, he said, and what we're looking at now is a circular wall with a gap in the middle. The wall obstructed passage to a height of 21 kilometers, leaving a hole in the middle about 8 kilometers across. The plasma tube and singularity were not interrupted. Let's pass through and see what's on the other side, Lanier suggested. Then we'll decide where we want to come down. At a mere 6,000 kilometers per hour, Heinemann eased the tube rider down the singularity. The wall was a dirty bronze color, smooth and featureless. As they approached the hole, Carlson trained a telescope on the wall's upper surface, with some difficulty. It's only a meter thick at the top, she said. Judging by the color, I guess it's made out of the same stuff as the wells in the corridor. That is nothing, Farley said. Patricia's spatial building blocks. Heinemann reduced speed to a few hundred kilometers an hour, and they glided through the hole. On the opposite side, the view of the corridor floor was crystal clear, unobstructed by atmosphere. The floor was a chaotic mess of 100-kilometer-long gouges, black marks, and broad strips of revealed bronze corridor surface. The instruments confirmed their suspicions. No atmosphere, Farley said. The wall's a plug. Heinemann decelerated until they came to a stop 2,000 kilometers past the wall, now reduced in size to a tiny patch in the corridor's merciless perspective. What'll it be, he asked. We slide back and find a well circuit, Lanier said, just like we planned. We check that out, then we proceed, and we don't waste time. Research is really secondary. Yes, sir, Heinemann said. He swung the V-Stoll around on the tube rider to face the opposite direction. Hang on, full reverse coming up. 400 kilometers south of the wall, they located a circuit of wells and slowed to prepare the V-Stoll for its descent. All loose objects were made fast while Heinemann unlocked the aircraft from the tube rider. With a gentle nudge of the attitude jets, they eased away from the singularity. Heinemann oriented the craft with its nose toward the corridor floor. Unlike in the asteroid chambers, where some sort of push was required to move away from the axis, the V-Stoll began a slow, accelerating descent immediately, repelled by the singularity, or attracted by the floor, whichever way they cared to think of it. After falling 4 kilometers, Heinemann kicked in the rocket engine for 3 short bursts and pointed the plane's nose north. I wouldn't land this way in a chamber, he said, but it's the best tactic in the corridor. We won't hit the atmosphere on a spiral course here, so I'm going to take advantage of a long glide down. Gary, take hold of your controls and get the feel of what I'm doing. Lanier gripped the wheel and felt Heinemann's motions as he pulled the nose up. A rippling series of shudders announced atmospheric buffeting. Outside the walls, a whimpering whine began to decrease in pitch and increase in loudness. Heinemann brought down flaps to decrease their airspeed and gently swung the V-Stoll to the right, lowering the nose and deploying the prop blades from their receptacles in the engine nacelles. The smooth, beautiful roar of the twin turboprops made him smile like a little boy. "Ladies and gents," he said, "we are now an airplane. Gary, like to take it down?"
"My pleasure," Lanier said. "Passengers will please keep their seatbelts on."
"Aye, aye," Carlson said. "That was fun. Let's do it again," Farley called forward.
"Terrain looks smooth enough, but we'll fly over and decide whether we want a short landing or a vertical touchdown," Heinemann said.
Lanier banked the aircraft and circled around a well, then flew over the cupola at about 50 meters, slowing by angling the props up. Heinemann peered at the prospective landing sites and signaled thumbs up. "Short roll. It's smooth sand down there."
Lanier brought the V-stall down on the corridor floor at 50 kilometers an hour, gently and easily, nose pointed at the dimple and cupola of the well. He then reduced the pitch on the props and taxied, nose bombing, to the edge of the dimple, pivoting the plane until it was tangent to the well's outer circle. The engine's roar dropped rapidly to silence.
"Bravo," Heinemann said.
"God, that was great," Lanier said. "I haven't flown in 6 years, and I've never flown like that. Jesus, you look at the ground and it seems like you're always going to fly right into it."
"If you two flyboys will give us a hand," Carlson interrupted, "we'll get our work done faster."
Carlson took photographs and Farley made instrument readings as they skirted the dimple. The well was open. That much was obvious, even from a distance. 10 or 11 meters from the floating cupola was a platform cradling two irregular red and black checked spheres, each 3 meters in diameter and sporting a pair of Waldos front and back. They descended the slope of the dimple and inspected the platform. Heinemann climbed a ladder built into one side of the platform and walked along a scaffold passing above the checked spheres.
"Spacesuits," he said. "Tough ones, too."
"Here's a message," Farley called out.
She pointed to a bronze-colored plaque mounted on a pedestal near the mouth of the well. The alphabet was Latin-esque with discernible A's, G's, and E's, but none of them could decipher the words.
"It's not Greek, and it's not Cyrillic," Carlson said. "It must be Stoner, some new language."
She photographed it from three sides and beneath.
"I never encountered anything like it in the libraries," Lanier said.
He stepped beyond the plaque and felt a sudden molasses-like resistance around the lip of the well.
"Warning," a deep, forbidding masculine voice announced out of nowhere. "Warning to be heeded by speakers of 20th century English. Do not attempt to enter any gate in this region without proper environmental protection. Conditions of high gravitation and corrosive atmosphere prevail beyond the gate entrance. Suits are provided for your protection. Warning."
Carlson touched the plaque and whistled.
"Look," she said.
The letters of the plaque had reformed into Roman alphabet English and repeated what the voice had said aloud.
"Now that's service."
Heinemann ran his hands along the upper surface of one of the spheres and found a depression in a black square. He pressed it cautiously. Nothing happened.
"Excuse me," Farley said to no one in particular.
Lanier turned toward her and she smiled, embarrassed, and held up her hand. She then addressed the underside of the cupola.
"Excuse me, but if we wish to enter the well, the gate, how do we use the suits, the path escapes?"
"Bath escapes," Carlson corrected.
"Yes. How do we use whatever they are?"
"Vehicles respond to vocal commands and can be adjusted to your language. Do you have proper authorization for a gate excursion?"
"What sort of authorization?" Farley asked.
"Authorization from the Nexus. All gates are controlled by the Nexus. Please present authorization within 30 seconds, or this band of gates will be locked against tampering." They stared back and forth at each other as the time passed. "No authorization," the voice announced without inflection. "These gates are now closed until a survey team investigates and corrects the situation." Lanier pulled back from the invisible barrier. The 20-meter-wide opening at the center irised in silently and formed a smooth bronze bulge. On the scaffold, Heinemann yelped and jumped clear as the spheres and cradle slowly sank into the surface of the dimple, vanishing without trace. Farley swore in melodious Chinese.
"Oh, well," Carlson said, sighing. "We didn't have time to be tourists anyway."
The bland landscape around the well consisted of flat stretches of sand without any sign of life. The air was dry, and soon their noses and throats were parched. It was with some relief that they boarded the V-stole, sealed the hatch, and prepared to return to the tube rider. "This is fun," Heinemann said. "She works like a charm." He lifted the V-stole from the ground and increased their speed by inclining the engine nacelles forward. They climbed steadily until they were within a kilometer of the plasma tube and the upper limits of the atmosphere. "Abracadabra," Heinemann said, withdrawing the blades into the nacelles and activating the tail rocket. With a sharp surge forward, they punched through the atmosphere barrier and plasma tube and entered the vacuum surrounding the singularity. Heinemann guided the V-stole with little pushes from the attitude jets, bringing it up beneath the tube rider and completing the link-up under direction of the plane's computers. "She's a beauty, isn't she?" he enthused, then shook his head and let out a puffed whoo. Chapter 37. "We're not going to get a disarmament agreement out of them anytime soon," Gerhardt said as he preceded Hoffman down the platform steps into the fourth chamber compound. "They're more afraid of each other than they are of us right now, and nobody's going to hand in their weapons until the situation is settled." "Who do you think will come out on top?"
Gerhardt shrugged. "No bets. They're all tough sons of bitches. My hopes are for Mirsky."
"He's been in the third chamber library more often than any of us," Hoffman said.
"He has more to catch up on," Gerhardt said. "Russians don't want soldiers with a liberal education."
"I suppose we should be happy with a ceasefire in separate camps."
Gerhardt opened the mess door for her, and she passed through into the cafeteria. Four agricultural scientists, one man and three women, waited for her with charts and slates. She shook hands with all of them and took a seat. Gerhardt received a meager lunch from the vendor and sat at the next table. This was not his direct concern.
"Food programs," Hoffman said. "Farming and subsistence. Okay, show me what we have to do."
Push came to shove barely 18 hours after the conference in the bungalow. The first chamber storm settled even more quickly than it started. The winds suddenly stopped, the clouds unleashed a few more drops and then dissipated. The tube light brightened, and the air felt warmer. Filizersky ordered a platoon to surround the bungalow and capture Mirsky. The ostensive reason was Mirsky's lack of dedication to the cause of socialism, but all three Zampolites felt the lieutenant general was weak and would soon make concessions to Hoffman that the Soviets could ill afford. The platoon moved in quickly and surrounded the command center, bringing their AKVs to bear on the 20 guards. The guards surrendered without resistance, and Bilozerski approached the bungalow door to place Mirsky under arrest. Three burly troopers kicked in the door and poked their rifles through, keeping their heads and bodies back. "Comrade General," Bilozerski shouted, his voice breaking, "you have violated the confidence of your men. In the name of the newly reconstituted Supreme Soviet, you are under arrest." The troopers swung around the doorframe and into the bungalow. Pletnyov sat up on a bunk, blinking sleepily. "General Mirsky's not here," he said thickly. "Is there anything I can do for you?" Vyogorsky had napped briefly after the conference with Mirsky, then taken advantage of the weakening storm to move three trucks with 50 soldiers out of the first chamber and to ride the 90-tube train, reserved exclusively for Russian use, into the fourth chamber. The plan was to have him out of the way when Bilozerski arrested Mirsky, just in case something went wrong. For a few hours, then, he could enjoy the fourth chamber woods. He especially enjoyed the sight of soldiers in the development detail bringing down trees and hauling them to the water. Stories of the conquest of the East and the building of the Trans-Siberian Railway had enchanted him as a boy. Now he visualized something similar in the potato, a series of Soviet settlements linked by roads, clearing fields for farms and building cabins. Something good might come out of this fiasco after all, he thought. A purer, less corrupt, and more tightly controlled socialist community, which could eventually take over the asteroid and return to Earth to complete the task Lenin had begun 80 years before. Things were moving with astonishing speed already. Only 9 days ago, they had made their landing, and now they had been ceded territory in the most attractive of the potato's seven chambers. If this didn't demonstrate the weakness of their opponents, what possibly could?
Three SSTs approached him. The lead trooper carried a few papers, no doubt for him to sign in his capacity as director of Fourth Chamber Exploitation. "Colonel," the first soldier said, pulling a pistol from behind the papers. He pointed the pistol at Yogorsky and tipped his cap higher. "Mirsky," Yogorsky said, losing none of his control. The other two soldiers were Pogodin and the scientist Pritikin. Each carried an AKV slung over his shoulder. Mirsky took Vilgorsky's arm and poked the pistol into his side, near the kidneys. "Not a word, please." "What are you doing?" Vilgorsky whispered harshly. Mirsky thrust the pistol forward with more force. "Quiet! Your rat is gnawing a hole in my bungalow." They walked with measured steps to a truck waiting by the lake shore. Pogodin unceremoniously pushed Vilgorsky into the back and threw a tarp over him, climbing in after and lightly tapping the barrel of the AKV on the bulge his head made. Mirsky climbed behind the steering column and looked across the dark sands to the soldiers in the woods. Another group was playing lopta, a kind of baseball, with branches and pine cones. None seemed concerned with the truck or its occupants. "Where are we going, General?" Vilgorsky asked from the rear, voice muffled by the tarp. "Quiet, sir," Pogodin said, prodding him again with the AKV. Chapter 38. The chaotic and scarred section of the corridor stretched for 500,000 kilometers, airless and barren. Plans for a second sortie to the floor were abandoned. Without an atmosphere, ascent and descent would use an exorbitant amount of fuel. If the barren segment continued past their 1,000,000-kilometer turnaround point, they would abandon the mission and reverse course, Lanier decided. "Do you think all of it's like this?" Farley asked, sitting next to him. "From here on?" Lanier shook his head. "They took Patricia somewhere." "Have you thought about the wells? Perhaps they left the corridor and we can't follow." "I thought of that, and I have a hunch they didn't use a well." "Another wall," Heinemann announced. They gathered in the cockpit. Carlson sitting in the co-pilot's seat, and Farley and Lanier jammed into the hatchway. Lanier was all too aware of the press of Farley's body. The tube rider's passage through the corridor was dizzying. It reminded Lanier of running through a drain pipe. The corridor fled past on all sides, purple and brown and black with its scars, the revealed corridor surface dirty bronze. The forward-looking radar returned a steady beep at half-second intervals. "Seats, please," Heinemann said. "We're going to slow this sucker down. Reverse seats this time. I want to keep our FLR facing forward, and there'll be about 0.2 G. Carlson strapped herself into the co-pilot's seat with a pixie grin at Lanier. "Back seat, boss," she said. "I was here first." Lanier and Farley crawled past the equipment boxes and sat next to each other. Lanier took a deep breath and closed his eyes. The urge was almost unbearable. "Something wrong?" Farley asked. "Not at all." He touched her hand reassuringly with his own and drew it back. "You feeling all right?" He smiled unconvincingly and nodded. "Something's wrong, Gary. I've been around you long enough." "We'll be there in an hour or so," Heinemann announced from the cockpit. "So what is it?" Farley pursued. He took a deep breath and his face reddened. "I can't help it, Karen. It's crazy. I've been horny for the last 20 hours. It isn't going away." She regarded him without expression, and then her eyes widened the merest fraction. "You asked, damn it," he said.
"Just in general?"
"No."
"Someone in particular?"
"Yes," he said.
"Who?
Or is that asking too much?" He raised a finger and pointed it at her, shaking with stifled laughter. His face was red as hamburger now, and he sounded like he was choking.
"That's funny."
"No," he said, finally controlling his laughter.
"It's crazy." "You've never been interested in me before?"
"No.
I mean, yes, you're attractive, obviously, but..." "Then shut up."
The deceleration had already started. She unbuckled her belt and fell slowly toward the cockpit, easing herself along with the hand grips on the side of the seats and storage racks overhead. Wait, Lanier said, reaching for her and missing. He looked back over the neck rest. Karen! Farley hung in the cockpit hatchway. Wake us when we're at the wall, she said pointedly, sliding the partition shut with a decisive snick of the bolt. She pulled herself back along the aisle and braced one knee against his seat and the seat opposite. I'm sorry, Lanier began.
Not at all, Farley said.
She tugged at her jumpsuit zipper and pulled it down, revealing a T-shirt with the Chinese character Jin Yuo on the front, signifying whale, the Chinese name for the stone. She shimmied it off quickly and removed white cotton panties. Lanier watched in shock.
You should have said something sooner, she admonished. Anything that keeps you from thinking straight is a detriment to our mission.
She pulled the T-shirt over her head and stuffed all the clothes in a rear seat pouch. He removed his jumpsuit, glancing nervously at the cockpit partition. She lay on the rear of the two opposite seats. The cube rider's deceleration provided an effective, if skewed, sense of direction.
You never did put yourself on the social roster, Farley said, taking his hand and pulling him toward her. Not because you were shy, surely.
Lanier touched her breast, his heart hammering. He gently rubbed the knuckles and backs of his fingers along the line between her hips and stomach. I've never needed anyone more in my life, he said. Carols had ascended the ladder up the middle of the aisle. Farley and Lanier had dressed and seated themselves opposite each other.
10 minutes and we'll be there, Carolson said, deadpan.
She looked at Farley and then turned her head toward Lanier, her eyes lingering for a moment on Farley's face.
It seems like the same sort of wall as the last one, but this one rises even higher above the level of the atmosphere, with a narrower clearance, no more than 100 meters, around the singularity. We should run the same tests we did before, though.
Agreed, Farley said. Gary, Carolson began, regarding him intently.
What?
Never mind. She descended the ladder and returned to the cockpit.
Jesus, I'm embarrassed, Lanier muttered.
Why? Because you're human, Farley asked.
I have responsibilities, he said.
There isn't a person on the stone who doesn't, she said. And there was an awful lot of hemky-pemky going on while I was there.
Despite himself, he chuckled. That's hanky-panky.
Whatever. Don't tell me you didn't notice.
He shook his head.
No, I honestly didn't. The boss is the last to know.
Only if the boss has his eyes shut. I doubt Hoffman is letting such things escape her.
All right, so I'm a...
I don't know.
I'm not a prude, but I may be a bit innocent.
Not innocent at all, Farley said, reaching across to touch his arm.
And don't worry. You're still the boss.
Chapter 39 Vilgorsky had difficulty keeping his calm. He sweated profusely and smelled bad. His voice was hoarse. Mirsky almost felt sorry for him. The black entranceway to the third chamber library opened impressively, and Bogodin and Pritikin urged the captive through with a few well-placed jabs of their AKVs. Mirsky followed at a more leisurely pace.
This is where you've been wasting your time, Vilgorsky cried over his shoulder.
You've never been here? Mirsky asked, pretending surprise.
At the very least, I would have thought you'd be curious.
It's useless, Vilgorsky said. It's filled with American propaganda. Why waste my time?
Mirsky laughed out loud, more in anger than humor.
You poor son of a bitch, he said. The people who built this starship were no more American than you or I.
They halted before the ranks of chairs and chromium teardrops.
If you kill me, Bilozerski and Yazykov are fully capable of carrying on, Vilgorsky said.
I'm not going to kill you, Mirsky said. We need each other. I want you to sit down.
Vilgorsky stood his ground, shivering like a cold dog.
The chairs won't eat you, Pogodin said, prodding him again.
You cannot brainwash me, Vilgorsky blustered.
No, but maybe I can educate you. Sit.
Vilgorsky slowly lowered himself into the nearest chair, facing the teardrop apprehensively.
You will force me to read books? That will be very silly.
Mirsky came around behind the chair and reached over to flip the control cover.
Would you like to learn how to speak English, French, German?
Bielgorsky didn't answer.
No?
Then perhaps you'd like to learn a little about history. Not from an American point of view, from the viewpoint of our descendants, the Russians who survived the death.
I don't care, Bielgorsky said, his pale, moist face almost all nose in the teardrop reflection.
This is what the Americans were hiding from us, Mirsky said. Isn't it your duty to inspect the treasure we were fighting for?
Your superiors cannot. They are dead, or soon will be. The entire earth will be covered with smoke for years to come. Millions will starve to death or freeze. By the end of this decade, there will be less than 10 million of our countrymen left alive.
You're talking nonsense, Bielgorsky said, wiping his face with his sleeve.
Our descendants built this starship, Mirsky said. That's not propaganda. It sounds like fantasy, but it's truth, Bielgorsky. And all our squabbling with each other cannot conceal the truth. We trained and came here and fought and died to find the truth. You would be a traitor to turn away from it.
Are you proposing we share power? Bielgorsky asked, glancing up at him.
Mirsky swore under his breath and turned on the machine.
It will speak to you in Russian, he said. It will answer your questions, and it will teach you how to use it. Now ask.
Bielgorsky stared at the floating library symbol, eyes wide.
Ask!
Where do you want me to start?
Start with our past, what they taught us in school.
The symbol changed to a question mark.
Teach me about...
Bielgorsky looked up at Mirsky.
Go on. It isn't painful, but it is addictive.
Teach me about Nicholas the First.
That's pretty safe, Mirsky said. Too far back. Ask it to teach you about the grand strategic plan of the Soviet army from 1960 to 2005.
Mirsky smiled.
Weren't you ever curious?
Teach me about that, then, Bielgorsky said.
The library silently searched and organized his presentation, numerous colorful utility symbols flickering around Bielgorsky's field of view. Then it began. After a half hour, Mirsky turned to Pogodin and Pritikin and told them to go back to the fourth chamber. He nodded at the entranced Bielgorsky.
He'll be no trouble. I'll watch him.
When will we get our chance? Pritikin asked.
Anytime you're free, comrade, Mirsky said. It's open to all.
Bielizersky jerked the muscular Pletnyov up from his chair and swung him around with surprising strength.
I know fantasies when I hear them, he growled.
It's easily proven, Pletnyov said, his head turned to one side to avoid Bielizersky's fist on his collar.
We must go there. Comrades Pritikin and Sinoviev have told us as much as they know. The seventh chamber does not stop. It goes on forever.
Bielizersky let him go and backed away slowly, fists clenched.
Deviationist crap. Pritikin and Sinoviev are intellectuals. Why should I believe them?
Yazykov motioned for the three soldiers to take Pletnyov by the arms.
You sold us into defeat for your own miserable skin, he said. It was your duty to die out there, not come sniveling to the Americans.
It was finished, Pletnyov said. We had no other choice.
This rock can be ours, Yazykov shouted. Now, where is Mirsky?
I've told you, he's in the fourth chamber.
Shit, he's in his beloved library, Bielizersky said.
Then that's where we'll arrest him, Yazykov said. Now we should find Garabedian and Anyankovsky. They're Mirsky's men as well.
Comrade Pletnyov, I will personally execute you against the far wall of the seventh chamber. I will spread your blood and counter-revolutionary brains on solid proof of your gullibility.
He threw his hands up in the air in disgust.
Keep him here until we find the others.
Rimskaya walked across the compound with the message from Bielizersky in his hand. He climbed the steps to what had once been Lanier's office, and was now Hoffman's, and knocked on the door. Darrell Wallace answered.
Message from the Soviets, he said tersely. His face was pale, and he looked as if he hadn't slept in days.
Something important? Darrell asked.
Darrell, don't play the protective underling with me. Where is Judith?
She's downstairs in conference with the medical supervisor. I'm not being officious, Joseph, but she's very busy.
Yes, well, the Soviets are busy being Soviets, and I think there's going to be trouble. He wiped his eyes and blinked owlishly.
I'll get her. She'll meet you downstairs by the secretary's desk.
Rimskaya grunted and clumped back down the stairs. Hoffman emerged from the executive conference room and took the slate from Rimskaya's hand, reading it over quickly. She also looked exhausted, though less so than Rimskaya. Her eyes were rimmed with purple, and her cheeks were puffy from lack of sleep.
What is Bilizersky? Position, rank?
A zampolit, political officer, Rimskaya said. His hands were shaking. Major. I've talked with him once or twice.
What did you think of him?
Rimskaya shook his head grimly. Hardliner, ignorant and unimaginative. These other two, Yazykov and Byogorsky, they worry me. They're smarter, more dangerous. If they say they've deposed Mirsky, and we have to deal with them directly, they've probably done it.
Then arrange a meeting. We can't just stop talking because of their internal squabbles. And find out from, what's his name, Sinoviev or Pritikin. Find out from one or the other what's going on and how this affects the Russian civilians. They aren't around. They may be in detention or dead.
You think it's gone that far? Hoffman asked. They're acting very Russian, Rimskaya said, spreading his hands. I'll be in this conference for another hour or so. Get them to meet with us in an hour and a half. Better to let them suggest the time and then make them wait a while, Rimskaya suggested.
You take care of it.
She watched the tall, dour mathematician walk out the door and then stared at a blank space on the wall over Anne's empty desk. The secretary was in the cafeteria on lunch break.
Just 30 seconds, Hoffman said, focusing on nothing.
She stood alone, breathing steadily, one finger tapping lightly on the corner of the desk, beating time to some internal meditative clock. When half a minute had passed, she closed her eyes tightly, opened them wide, took a deep breath, and turned back to the hallway and the conference room door. Chapter 40. The tube rider slid slowly past the second wall. On the opposite side, beginning about a kilometer from the wall and paralleling it, around the circumference of the corridor, a series of dark, brick-colored structures squatted on the bare bronze floor. Each sat on a square base about 200 meters on a side, rising in a series of steps. Each step level twisted slightly, creating a rounded, half-spiral pyramid. Bingo, Heinemann said, pointing down the throat of the corridor. The floor was alive with moving lights channeled into lanes. The lanes piled many layers deep, like a super-dense freeway system. We are not alone.
How far have we come? Carlson asked.
770,000 kilometers, give or take two, Heinemann said. Gary, could you pilot for a bit? I'm going to run more tests. We'll just keep moving ahead slow, 90 or 100 kilometers an hour, Lanier said. That's about right. I don't feel very easy about meeting the inhabitants, whatever they may be, Heinemann said, shaking his head as he climbed out of the seat. They were weightless again, moving at a steady velocity.
Why would we worry? I mean, besides the obvious reasons, Farley asked.
The obvious reason would be bad enough, but frankly, I'm not happy about coming along the singularity. It's just occurred to me whoever's down there might not like people traveling this way. Maybe there are other vehicles, authorized vehicles. Maybe there's something else. Whatever. If we were to come zipping along at 8 or 9 clicks a second, anything we hit would be in serious trouble. That's enough to get us a moving violation, wouldn't you say?
I hadn't thought of that, Lanier said, settling into the pilot seat.
Yes, well, now that your head is more clear, Heinemann glanced at him sternly and then patted him on the shoulder. Girls, let's find out what all the fuss is. They replaced various instruments in ports along the floor of the aircraft and installed new sensors in ports so far unoccupied. Lanier stared overhead at the corridor floor, fascinated by the procession of lights. Even with binoculars, he couldn't make the lights resolve into anything but bright spots, contrasting against the black of the lanes. Something large and gray covered his field of view in the binoculars, and he pulled them down. A disk, at least half a kilometer wide, floated slowly above the lanes, moving south. Another disk followed a similar course, 20 or 30 degrees to the west. Absolutely no coherent radio signals, Heinemann said.
waste microwaves and heat, and a little X and gamma ray activity, and that's it. Radar, the repeater back here, shows something substantial about a quarter of a million kilometers ahead. Surface area of at least 15 square kilometers, right on the axis, dead center. I see it, Lanier said, looking at the primary display. Objects moving around it, and all along the wall of the corridor. Don't ask me what they are, Heinemann said, peering through the windscreen at the gray disks. He squinted in puzzled anxiety. And don't ask me how long we're going to stay up here unmolested.
At least we're small, Farley said. Maybe they won't notice us.
That big thing up ahead, whatever it is, will notice us, Heinemann said. 10 to 1, it's riding the singularity, too. 500 kilometers past the wall, four large, brick-red twisted pyramids rose above the tangle of lanes. From their spacing, equidistant around the circumference, at the quadratic points, Lanier surmised they were built over wells. From this distance, they appeared the size of a commemorative postage stamp held at arm's length, which made them perhaps 2 kilometers on a side and a kilometer high. Kilometer-wide clear lanes extended straight north from each structure for as far as he could see.
I think we're in over our head, Lanier murmured.
Farley put her hand on his shoulder and pulled herself into the co-pilot's seat.
We've been over our heads for years, haven't we?
I'd always assumed the corridor was empty. I don't know why. Perhaps because I couldn't have imagined this. Heinemann floated between them and gripped the bar on the instrument panel to steady himself while he programmed the flight plan. We're going to accelerate to 10,000 clicks an hour, get as close as we can to that big object on the singularity, slowing down on the approach so they won't think we're going to ram them, then reverse and hightail for home. That is, of course, if you approve. He raised an eyebrow in Lanier's direction. Lanier weighed the risks and realized he had no idea what they were. If we reverse now, what can we tell the folks back home? Heinemann persisted. It's obvious this place is important, but we have no idea what is it, or what it means to us once we're back on the stone.
You're stating the obvious, Larry, Lanier said. Now tell me whether we'll survive or not.
I don't know, Heinemann said, but I'm having the time of my life. What about the rest of you?
Carolson laughed. You're crazy, she told him. Crazy jock pilot engineer.
Heinemann wagged his head back and forth and proudly lifted the breast pockets of his jumpsuit out with his thumbs.
Gary?
We have to find out somehow, he admitted.
Let's go, then.
Heinemann began the sequence on the computer pilot, and the tube rider bore down on the singularity, once again putting a sense of direction into the V-stole cabin. When the acceleration stopped and the tube rider coasted at 10,000 kilometers an hour, Heinemann distributed supper, sandwiches and foil packets and bulbs of hot tea. They ate in silence, Carolson and Heinemann strapped to the bulkhead behind the cockpit. The corridor's passage was steady and easily perceptible. Another circuit of rectangular structures passed, and several minutes later, yet another, all connected by the four straight clear lanes and the crowded, tangled lanes of lights. Lanier vacated the seat to Carolson and took a nap while Heinemann trained the women in the fine points of tube rider control. He dropped in and out of a dream about flying a light plane over jungle and tangled rivers. Somehow that segued into a track meet. He awoke with the aftertaste of tea in his mouth and undid the seat belts, pulling himself forward. Farley was adjusting instruments in their ports and replacing memory blocks on the slates, collecting and collating the data. She dropped full blocks into a plastic sorting tray and slipped it into a file box. Then she held up one of the auxiliary multimeters built by engineering before the death, pointing out the display for Lanier's inspection.
Yes, he asked, looking down at the flickering numbers.
It's kaput, she said, putting out nonsense. So are most of our instruments. We'll be lucky to interpret half the data we've gathered.
Reasons?
She shook her head.
Wild guesses, and that's the best I can do. Other electrical systems seem to be working, so it's possible we're passing through control fields like those that selectively damp inertia on the stone. These fields damp other effects. Distorted geometry's effect on activity in the nucleus, changes in slash H, or the equipment may be crapping out all at once. Warranty expires today. Surprise.
The equipment's fine, Heinemann called out from the co-pilot seat. Don't blame my machines.
The man's so proprietary, Farley marveled. He gumbles every time I question quality control.
Grumbles, not gumbles, Lanier said.
Whatever.
Your turn, Lanier told Heinemann, indicating the rear of the plane with his thumb. Nap time. We'll all need to be bright and cheerful. Heinemann adjusted the tube rider's roll and floated past Lanier.
Wait, Carrollson said. What's that?
The singularity ahead of the tube rider was no longer a shiny cylindrical surface. In intermittent pulses, it glowed orange and then white, like a hot steel wire. No rest for the wicked, Heinemann said, replacing Lanier in the pilot seat. He applied the tube rider clamps to the singularity to brake. The craft suddenly bucked and rolled violently, tossing Lanier and Farley against the storage rack and pinning them there until Heinemann released the clamps. We're accelerating, Heinemann shouted over the roaring shudder of the tube rider and airplane. I'm not in control anymore. Lanier slid toward the rear of the cabin, banging into seats with his arms and legs as he tried to grab hold of something. Farley clung to a seat tenaciously and struggled to swing around and sit in it. The singularity now drew a long, steady red line down the middle of the plasma tube. Lanier strapped himself into a seat and reached across to help Farley climb into hers. Equipment bounced and fell to the rear, striking storage racks, bulkheads, and other equipment.
Can you reverse us? Lanier shouted over the tumult.
No way, Heinemann answered. If I clamp down, we start bucking. 30,000 and still accelerating. The tube rider rolled again, and Lanier and Farley shielded themselves against another onslaught of rebounding memory block racks, test kits, and coiled light cables.
40,
Heinemann said a few moments later.
50.
The radio crackled and chuffed, and a genderless melodic voice began in mid-phrase.
Violation of the law of the way. Your craft is in violation of the law of the way. Do not resist, or your craft will be destroyed. You are under the direction of the Hexamon Nexus, and will be removed from the flaw in 6 minutes. Do not attempt to either accelerate or decelerate.
The message ended with a soft burst of white noise. Chapter 41 Belozersky stood stiffly to the rear of Yazykov at the conference table, hands locked behind his back. Yazykov sat with his hands folded on the table. Hoffman looked over the demands and wrote out a quick translation on her slate for Gerhardt. Gerhardt read them quickly and shook his head.
We reject your demands, Hoffman said flatly in Russian. She too had spent time in the third chamber library.
These men are criminals, Yazykov said. They have kidnapped one of our colleagues and hidden in one of the cities where we cannot find them.
Whether that's true or not, we already agreed to separate governmental and judicial systems. We can't help you find these men without breaking our agreement.
They are hiding in sectors dominated by your people, Belozersky said. You yourself may be hiding them.
If that's the case, then I've been told nothing about it, Hoffman said. I doubt it.
Surely you support our attempt to form a civilian government, Yazykov said.
We don't support it and we don't oppose it, Hoffman said. That's your concern. Our concern at this table is with our peaceful coexistence, nothing more.
Yazykov rose quickly and nodded at Hoffman. They crossed the cafeteria and exited through the rear door.
What do you make of that? Hoffman asked Gerhardt.
The general shook his head ruefully and grinned. Mirsky's stolen their main man, he said. Looks like he anticipated them and made the first move.
What's your opinion of Mirsky?
Hardline Soviet military or not, I'd rather deal with him than with Yazykov or Belozersky.
So, do we help him?
Help Mirsky? Hell no. First instincts are best. We stay out of it and let them settle it themselves. Besides, Mirsky won't ask for help. We just have to hope it doesn't come to a fight. We might not be able to stay out of that. Mirsky and Pogodin removed Vyogorsky from the third chamber city in the truck, following a tortuous series of service roads until they found a main artery that crossed the remaining 20 kilometers in a straight line. The artery emerged through a number of open half-moon gates onto the 90 tunnel leading to the second chamber. Mirsky examined several buildings along the second chamber thoroughfares before picking one that suited him. It was hidden between one of the giant chandelier skyscrapers the Americans called megas and a long row of 100-meter-high asteroid rock towers of no apparent utility. The building was only 4 stories tall and seemed to have once been a kind of school. Long rows of connected seats filled the 3 rooms on each floor, facing slate-black walls rimmed with silvery glass. In the easternmost room of the top floor, they spread their supplies, and Mirsky sat down with a much quieter and even more somber Vilgorsky. Pogodin went to hide the truck. "I don't thank you," Vilgorsky said. He lay back on a bench and stared at the gold stars on the dark blue ceiling. "My father died in Afghanistan. I was told nothing about his death. State secret. I still don't know. But that it was all a military exercise to battle test the army..." He shook his head wonderingly. "A 10-year exercise to find..." He coughed into his fist. "To find that all one has believed has been an orchestrated lie." "Not all," Mirsky said. "Much, but not all. Having one's eyes opened doesn't make one grateful." "We've always known bits and pieces, haven't we?" Mirsky asked. "About the corruption, the inefficient and incompetent and venal superiors, the state preserving itself at the expense of revolutionary ideals. Every man must work with such things, if not accept them. But using our finest athletes and dancers as concubines. Hypocrisy mixed with stupidity. How much worse for a government that says it is above scandal and cannot do wrong. At least the Americans wallow in their scandal." They talked for 2 hours. Pogodin returned. He listened attentively, his brow wrinkling when they discussed things that pained him. He interrupted only once to ask, "Haven't the Americans discovered how corrupt they are?" Mirsky nodded. "They have always known, or at least as often as their press could uncover the facts." "Their press is not controlled." "Manipulated, yes," Mirsky said. "Never completely controlled. They had thousands of historians, each with his own perspective. Their history was confused, but deliberate distortions were usually found out." Pogodin looked between Vyagorsky and Mirsky, and then turned away to walk to the entrance of the room. "What we've been told about Stalin, Khrushchev, Brezhnev, Gorbachev..." Vyagorsky let his words trail off with a shake of his head. "Is different from what our fathers were told," Mirsky finished for him, "and their fathers before them." And they talked for another hour, this time about life in the army. Mirsky described how he had nearly become a political officer. Vyagorsky outlined the accelerated training courses he and the other Zampolits had been given before being launched with the space shock troops from the Indian Ocean. "We are not so far apart after all," Vyagorsky said, as Mirsky poured him water from a thermos. Mirsky shrugged again and handed him the cup. "You know the responsibilities of a political officer. The duty to party, to the revolution." "What revolution?" Mirsky asked softly. Vyagorsky's face reddened. "We must still be loyal to the revolution. Our lives, our sanity depends on it." "The revolution begins here, now," Mirsky said. "We are unloaded of the past." They regarded each other for an uncomfortably long time. Pogodin returned to find them silent and sat to one side, gripping the index finger of one hand with thumb and forefinger of the other and tugging it uneasily. "The power must be shared," Vyagorsky said. "The party must be reestablished." "Not by murderers and louts," Mirsky said sharply, jaw muscles tensing. "We have had enough of them. Russia has been raped by murderers and louts too long in the name of revolution and the party. No more. I will end it all here rather than bring this back to our children on earth." Vyagorsky fumbled at his pocket, pulling out an antique gold watch. "Bizersky and Yazykov will be frantic by now. There's no telling what they will do if they don't hear from me." "That weakens them," Mirsky said. "Let them sit for a while, or hang themselves." Vyagorsky grinned wolfishly and shook his finger at Mirsky. "You bastard. I know what you are. You're a visionary. A deviationist visionary.
And I'm the only one you can be comfortable with, sharing the power, Mirsky said. You know they will come after you eventually. You can no more trust them than you can trust a mad dog. Yegorsky did not look convinced. Maybe now we understand each other. Yegorsky shrugged and turned down the corners of his mouth. At 1200 hours the next day, Pogodin aimed the truck's antenna toward the southern borehole, and Yegorsky sent a message to Yazykov and Bilozersky. Our fourth chamber troops have captured Mirsky and henchmen in third chamber library. Join us there. Trial will be held in library. Chapter 42. They watched in silence as the red line of the singularity guided them toward the black shield. Lanier joined Farley and Carrollson in the rear, trying to make sense out of the instruments. They periodically registered meaningful data, but not often enough to be of much use. Something approaching along the singularity. It's a machine, big and black, Heinemann said. Coming up fast. Lanier pushed himself forward. Straddling the glowing red line, a machine twice as thick as the tube rider, round in cross-section, bore down on them, its surface a glossy black. Bright purple lines on the machine's surface outlined squares and rectangles in symmetric arrays. Lanier watched in fascination as the squares and rectangles opened to extrude grapplers and a variety of jointed arms. It now resembled a deep ocean submersible, or a madman's Swiss army knife. What's it going to do? It's matching speed. Looks like it's... Colored lights flashed in the cabin. Heinemann flinched and drew back. Lanier closed his eyes and batted out with his hands. What was that? Carrollson called from the rear. Red and green translucent objects danced again before Lanier. He reached out to touch one, but it was insubstantial. They're symbols or something, Heinemann said. You see them? I see them, Lanier said. I don't know what they are or where they're coming from. The radio hissed again. Please state your identity and reason for approaching the Axis City shield. Lanier took the mic from Heinemann. I'm Gary Lanier. That'll clue them, he thought ruefully. We're exploring. If there are problems, do you wish an advocate? I'm sorry, what? You will be assigned an advocate immediately. Are you a corporeal human claiming the appropriate rights in the Hexamon Court? Say yes, Carrollson advised. Yes. You will now be removed from the floor and escorted to Axis Nader. The machine ran one arm down the underside of the tube rider. Flying sparks obscured the windscreen. The V-stole rolled and vibrated. Gas hissed against the fuselage, and alarms went off in the cockpit. There was a wrenching sound, and with a jerk they floated free. The tube rider had been cut from the singularity and cast adrift. The V-stole had then been removed from the tube rider. Heinemann peered up at the bright red line in the dark machine, which still clung to the stern of the mangled and useless tube rider. It's pulled us out of the mounting, he said, voice thick with anger. The aircraft had drifted 30 or 35 meters. I'm going back to check integrity. Lanier pulled himself into the co-pilot's seat. He methodically strapped himself in and tried to control his breathing. Just like ditching, he thought. No worse, perhaps better. I don't hear any leaks, but I'd still rather be down in an atmosphere, Heinemann called from the cabin. The machine abandoned the tube rider and spread its grapples wide as it drifted toward the V-stole. Heinemann came forward again, brushing between Carrollson and Farley. Shit, he said. It was the first time Lanier had ever heard him swear. The machine's bulk obscured the windscreen and the plane twisted. Floating in the cockpit hatchway, Heinemann did not roll with the craft. Lanier rotated around the startled engineer, then reversed. Hang on before the next one, he shouted. Heinemann grabbed for the pilot seat with one hand. The airplane spun around again, and like a martial arts master, used Heinemann's own mass to dislocate his shoulder. The engineer screamed and let go, now rolling in the opposite direction of the cabin. Lanier watched helplessly, waiting for the motion to stop. When the lull stretched out to 4 seconds, he unbuckled and held Heinemann around the waist, pushing him gently toward the rear. The engineer's face was a mask of pain. He opened his eyes wide like a child cruelly injured by a friend.
Carlson and Farley had sustained bruises, but no worse, before grabbing hand grips. Farley held Heineman's head, and Carlson took his kicking feet while Lanier inspected the arm.
"Son of a bitch!"
Heineman howled.
"Leave it alone!"
"The longer it's out, the longer it'll hurt," Lanier said. "I don't think anything's torn. Jesus, how do I reset in zero-G? Here, brace your foot in one of these stanchions, and we'll grab his torso," Carlson said. Heineman squirmed, wild-eyed. His short hair stuck out in all directions. Lanier hitched one foot under a rung and pressed the other against Heineman's ribs. Carlson and Farley tightened their hold on the engineer.
"Let me go,"
Heineman said weakly, his face slick with sweat and tears. Lanier grabbed one arm and forearm and pulled, braced and twisted all at once. Heineman screamed again and rolled his eyes until only whites showed. There was a satisfying billiard ball snick, and the arm was back in place. His head rolled limply and his mouth gaped. He had passed out. "He'll never forgive us now," Carlson said. "Wrap the shoulder in a cold compress," Lanier instructed. He pushed his face against the side port again. The machine obscured the windscreen. "Do not attempt to accelerate," the radio voice advised again. "Do not activate your drives. You are being taken to Axis Nadir." Farley helped Heineman into a seat. He lolled his head back to look at Carlson, his face pasty. Carlson inspected his eyes, prying the lids open with two fingers. "Shock," she said. She opened the first aid pack and took out a prepackaged syringe, injecting it into his uninjured arm. Lanier sat in the cockpit and tried to get whatever information he could from the instruments. The V-stole was moving rapidly. That much and little else was apparent. Olney entered the floor monitor room, picking his presidential access pass at the corporeal guard. The room was a high oval chamber filled with out-of-focus information pics directed at two neomorphs on monitor's duty. He floated to their position and was surrounded by detailed readouts on the destroyed and drifting tube writer and the airplane, now in control of a floor maintenance vehicle. "This is a security operation by extended order of the president," Olney picked it at the senior neomorph. "I cannot accept that," the neomorph replied. "This is a serious breach and must be reported to the courts at once. They will be assigned an advocate." "They already have an advocate. You must accept a direct order from a representative of the president," Olney said. The neomorph, shaped like an egg with traction field grappling arms extended to each side and a human face on the forward large end of the egg, surrounded itself with a picted white circle, signaling compliance under duress. But that was not enough for Olney. "By order of the president of the Infinite Hexamon Nexus, authority of the presiding minister, you are removed from this duty," he said. The neomorph protested furiously and garbled sound and red-shifted pics as it exited the chamber. Olney took the position, exchanging glances with the remaining neomorph. "This will not reach the court," he stated. "It has already been relayed," the second neomorph said. Olney telepicted a message to Suliram Kikura's office in Central City. A stylized personal emblem appeared before him. "Sir Ram Kikura is not available at the present. This is one of her partials. May I help?"
"This is an emergency. We have more guests. They are in violation of Hexamon law, and their case needs to be suppressed in court immediately. Authority of the presiding minister."
He pictured the code authority.
"Received," the partial said.
Then, in a completely lifelike image, the partial shook her head.
"Really, Olney, you bring us so much trouble."
The partial signed off, and Olney opened another channel to Axis Nadir, requesting that the Frant escort Patricia from her quarters to the inspection hangar. He ordered the clearing of all passageways between. That would arouse some suspicion and resentment, but he could see no way around it.
"And we'll need more quarters space."
The Frant also took his coded authority and signed off. Olney then turned his full attention to the floor maintenance device and the aircraft.
"They are uninjured?" he inquired, his pics demandingly purple-tinted.
"They have not been harmed by this station," the neomorph answered, appearing alarmed.
"You realize the secrecy of this operation?" he asked.
It assented in the meekest shade of green.
"Good. Then direct your vehicle and the violators to the inspection hangar."
Olney pushed himself from the station and the chamber and found the quickest shaft to access Nader.
"How many individuals are there within your craft?" the voice asked.
4, Lanier said. 1 injured.
"They are all corporeal humans?"
"We're all humans. What are you?"
"You are now in a reception area for illegal vehicles. Do not attempt escape. The area is sealed."
The machine removed its grapples and lifted away from the aircraft. Lanier saw they were in a broad, uncluttered hangar-like enclosure, the walls smooth black and gray. Slender silver cables coiled before the cockpit windscreen. The plane hung from cables attached to a pale silver torus suspended below the hangar ceiling. 3 large metallic gray mechanical workers surrounded the aircraft, pushing it along. They moved on 4 delicate jointed legs, their bulky bodies divided into hemispheres, connected by a narrow, flexible casing. There was no sign of human life in the hangar. At 2 points, elliptical portals about 4 meters wide opened in the walls, but they gave no clue as to who was preparing to greet them.
"Will you address the person who has tentatively confirmed your identity?" the voice asked, still as pleasant and melodic as ever.
"Who is it? I mean, who identified us?" The next voice was instantly recognizable.
"Gary, it's Patricia. There are 4 of you. Who are they?"
"That's her. We found her," Lanier said. "Or she's found us."
"I thought someone would come after me. It's just like I said. They're my friends."
Patricia leaned forward, hoping to receive the pictured images more clearly. She had spotted Lanier inside the cockpit.
"They must all be terrified."
She watched the Black Flaw patrol machine rise into its cavity above and behind the aircraft.
"They could be in serious trouble with the city authorities," Olmi said. "I'm trying to get the case cleared and suppressed, but I can't guarantee anything." "They've come looking for me," she said. "You can't blame them for that."
"They rode the axial flaw, and that's strictly forbidden."
"Yes, but how could they know?"
Olmi didn't answer.
"I know who they are," he said. "Your boss, Lanier, the scientist Carrollson, the Chinese Caucasian called Farley, and the engineer, Heinemann." "You recognize them? You kept track of all of us, didn't you?"
The mechanical workers pushed and guided the aircraft into a dilated entrance to a side chamber. The iris closed behind the plane, and the hangar lights darkened. Patricia stepped out of the chamber and took Olmi's proffered hand. He led her to the inspection hangar lock. Suliram Kikura entered the chamber. She had not yet met Patricia, but she had become fully acquainted with her. The advocate picked a brief conversation with Olmi. Patricia was not in line to pick up the exchanged visual symbols, not that she could have understood many of them anyway, but she could get the gist from the woman's attitude. The woman was a corporeal advocate. She was taking Olmi's deposition and relaying it to the pretrial court. The V-stole hatch opened. A worker settled on its jointed haunches a few yards away, sensors fully extended to record the disembarking of the passengers.
History, Patricia thought. We're all history here.
Lanier came out first. Patricia restrained an urge to wave to him. Instead, she lifted up on tiptoes and nodded. He returned the nod and descended the hatch steps. Farley came next. Carrollson waited in the doorway. Lanier pointed back into the cabin and said loudly, "We have an injured man inside. He may need assistance." Olmi and the woman conferred again, and the woman touched her silver torque. As she did so, she glanced at Patricia and smiled. Her picture projected an American flag above her left shoulder. She had American ancestors and was proud of it.
"What do we do?" Carrollson asked. "Leave him there?"
"Tell your friends a medical worker is coming," Olmi said in an undertone.
"He'll be okay. Help is coming," Patricia said.
Lanier tried to approach, but was blocked by a worker.
"Let him pass," Patricia pleaded. "Olmi, what harm can they do?"
"They're in quarantine," Olmi said, pointing to the glowing red line surrounding the V-stole at chest level. Patricia turned to Lanier, holding up one hand.
"They're not going to hurt you. Everything's okay. Just wait a moment."
"It's good to see you," Lanier said, keeping an eye on the scuttling workers. "We had no idea we'd ever find you."
Patricia swallowed back a lump in her throat. She turned to Olmi. We have to stay together, she told him. We have to help each other. Olmi smiled at her, but that didn't mean a cent. He picked it with the woman again, and she touched her necklace once more. A decision is being made now, he said. Whether they're criminals or guests, Patricia asked. Oh, they will be guests, the woman said in perfect English. They will be sampled now, Olmi said. Perhaps it would be best if you told them. Gary, Patricia said, they're really interested in our skin cultures. One of the workers, the machines, is going to approach you and collect skin scrapings. It doesn't hurt. And the cabin's waste tank. They'll want that, too. Here's the medical team, Olmi said. He would have to contact everyone involved later and have them swear out statements of secrecy. Two more corporeal citizens and a smaller worker entered the chamber and approached the red line. As they passed through, red chevrons appeared over their shoulders. They were now in quarantine also. Lanier, Carrollson, and Farley allowed the medical worker to pull back the sleeves of their jumpsuits and take samples. The worker then withdrew, touching the red line. It was instantly surrounded by a lovely lilac glow. When the glow dissipated, the worker crossed the line and came to a halt. The medical team, all homorphs, entered the aircraft hatch. A few minutes later, Heinemann walked out on his own power between them. The lead homorph picked a message to Olmi. He was in pain, but not seriously injured, Olmi told Patricia. They have relieved his pain, but have not yet given him healers. Virgin specimens, like me, right? Patricia asked. Olmi agreed and walked with her to the line. It vanished as they approached. Quarantine is over, the lead medical homorph stated. He picked at a few simplicities at Patricia, and she acknowledged the politeness. Then she rushed forward and hugged Lanier, Carrollson, and Farley, lingering with each. When Heinemann's turn came, she hugged him more gingerly. Don't spare me. I feel pretty good, he told her. Where in hell are we? End of Side 7.